Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today first joined us last year with her debut novel, The Henna Artist. It's a story that Reese Witherspoon said captivated her from the first chapter to the last page. In fact, she was so captivated with The Henna Artist that Reese made it her book club pick. Well, Alka Joshi is now a New York Times bestselling author. She joins us today with her second book, The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. It's set in India. It's a tale of loyalty, ambition, and love. And it plunges readers right back into the world of the henna artist, a world of power, money, corruption, and secrets. And I didn't even mention culture, because every page oozes culture. If you love reading and learning about different cultures, I'm pretty sure you'll love this story. So today we talk obviously about the book, we talk about some of the characters, we talk about some of the culture, and Alka also shares her creative process with us. She does things a little differently to many authors, and she also shares best practices for promoting your work, and she's done exceptionally well at that. So if you have a book to promote and you don't like talking yourself up, you want to listen to what she has to say. Let me tell you a little bit about Alka Joshi. She was born in Jodhpur, India. She's lived in the US since she was 9 years old. A Stanford graduate, she worked in advertising and PR before starting her own marketing consultancy. And in 2011, she earned an MFA in creative writing from the California College of Arts in San Francisco. Her new book is The Secret Keeper of Jaipur, and my guest, Alka Joshi. Alka Joshi, welcome to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
Well, it's such a pleasure, because we talked in June 2020. I looked it up. June 2020 was the last time we talked and the first time we talked. It was 13 months ago, right as the pandemic was ripping through our country. The Henna Artist was your first book. And listeners can find that conversation at conversationslive.net. But when we spoke, it was all so new for you and exciting to be in the launch process. Now you're coming back as a New York Times bestselling author and joining us today with your second novel, The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. So in a nutshell, how are you feeling? What's the past year been like for you?
Well, the past year has been such a blur, but filled with all kinds of wonderful things every single day. So, for example, Vicki, since I last talked to you, I have talked to over 440 book clubs, and those are all virtual.
I saw you won the prize for that.
Right. And also, I've had this amazing ability to connect to readers around the world. Now, how often do you get to do something like that, where people are telling you their life stories, they're sharing anecdotes about India or about their cultures that are similar to the South Asian culture I'm describing in my book? So it's been a wonderful year of connection as well. And then, you know, I get to talk to people now about book number two.
Yeah.
It is out already, and people are saying, wow, that was fast. But, you know, of course, I started working on book number two before the first book had even come out. So it's been a couple of years since I finished that.
Right. So let's talk about your new book. It's exciting for me when I interview a debut author, and then, you know, the book does so well and you've worked so hard to make it happen. And here is your second book, The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. So tell us, let's begin with a synopsis of this so listeners know what we're talking about. And the book begins with a prologue, which gives us a peek into the disaster that takes place. But I don't want to give away spoilers, so I'm going to turn it over to you to give the synopsis, Alka.
You know, what I wanted to explore in book number two is what happens after the happy ending. We leave the henna artist with Lakshmi going off to Shimla, Malik going off with her, Radha going off with her, and, you know, the things having to, you know, lick their wounds a little bit from all of the disaster that's happened in the henna artist. Now, in The Secret Keeper, what I wanted to explore is what happens after that happy ending? What happens to Lakshmi? How did she grow into her new position in Shimla? Did she and the good doctor get married? And what was that relationship like? What is it like for Lakshmi to be a parent figure to Malik? And what is it like for him to want to separate from his parent figure and to forge a life of his own with his beloved, Nimni, who is this nomadic woman whom he has met, who lives in Shimla because her husband died along the nomadic trek that her tribe was on. So I wanted to explore a lot of these relationships, but also at the same time, I've always wanted to write a mystery. So I have fashioned this into a mystery, and it kind of just happened organically. It wasn't like something I set out to do. But as Lakshmi wants to create a separation between Malik and his beloved, because she wants Malik to go off and have a career of his own, she arranges an apprenticeship for him at the Jaipur Palace. That's where he goes off, and that's where he meets up again with the Maharanis and the Singhs. And in doing so, in learning about the construction trade, he finds some underhanded things that are going on that actually cause many people to be injured. And he has to figure out what is going on truly so that he can protect all the people he loves, including his beloved all the way in Shimla and including Lakshmi all the way in Shimla.
Right. Now, I don't remember from, and I did listen to our last conversation, but I don't remember that this was going to be a trilogy, because you are actually writing a third book in the, right, following up from this one, too.
I don't know that I knew that it was going to be a trilogy, but it just sort of happened that way. You see, when I first wrote The Henna Artist, as you know, it took me 10 years to do it. I was living with these characters. I was also doing about 30 drafts of that first novel. So what that meant is that I had background material and future material on all of these characters that did not make it completely into that novel. So I had all this information where I thought, hey, you know what? I already know Malik's backstory. I know where he lives in the Pink City. I know why he has to leave Jaipur when he does. I know who has been taking care of him all of these years. And then there was this whole story about Radha. I know exactly what's going to happen to her because I had written so many different epilogues for book number one. So when it came time to write book number two, and it just flowed out because I already knew so much about these characters, I thought, well, now I have to complete it by telling you what happened to Radha, and that deserves a whole separate book of its own. So in book number three, Radha is living in Paris and working as a master perfumer, and her story continues from there.
Right, so we go from India to France. So jumping back to The Secret Keeper of Jaipur, one of the things that I don't know why it does this, but every time I hear the term Pink City, because that's where he goes, Malik, is it? Yes, goes back. He grew up there, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but every time I hear the Pink City, it conjures up all kinds of images for me. So paint a picture for listeners who've not read The Henna Artist about what this would be like.
The Pink City is sort of the interior of what the old city used to look like. You know, a long time ago, when these Maharajas had their kingdoms within the state of Rajasthan, they were all called princely states. And when they had these kingdoms, they would have walls around the kingdom. There would be a palace just right outside of the market square, and then inside this market square, everybody lived. They had their businesses. They played. They did everything inside that square. And every now and then, they would see the Maharaja, you know, coming in and saying hello to all his people. So the Pink City is that emblem of the old city where the Maharajas had all of their subjects. That's what the Pink City is referred to. The reason it's pink is because at the time of the visit from Prince Edward from England to Jaipur, the Maharaja of Jaipur decided that he wanted to paint this city in the color of hospitality. Pink is the color of hospitality in India. So that is why it has forever been known as the Pink City.
Oh, that's
there are thousands. Yeah, there are thousands and thousands of shops there. Thousands of people milling about, selling anything from hairpins all the way to tires, all the way to cars.
Interesting. I know for much of the first book, it was set in the same environment. Your father was your historian. Did you have to do any kind of any research beyond that for this book? I know a lot of the ideas were already there, but did you have to do further research for this book?
I had to do a lot of research in The Secret Keeper of Jaipur about the nomadic tribes. You know, all the different people who live in the Shimla area, I did a lot of research on them. And I found that there are these whole societies of nomads who have been around for centuries, who go up and down the mountain seasonally with their herds of goats and sheep and water buffalo. And they make a whole living doing these kinds of things. This is where we get a lot of our wool from. You know that whole thing about Pashmina shawls?
Yeah.
Well, it's a Pashmina, you know, the wool is extracted from a goat, a Pashmina goat that, you know, actually these nomads take care of. And as they go up and down the hills, their herds are grazing on all of these open areas. So I was just fascinated by doing research into them. I didn't even know they existed. And then once I got into them, I found out all about shearing sheep, which is something they do to sell their wool, or shearing their goats, and then the water buffalo and the cheeses and the milks that they sell from those. They really live a very very organic life. You know, they're living off the land. Mm. And so I thought it would be fascinating to have a character like Nimmi in this environment, and also have her be one of these nomads, but somebody who is choosing to live in the city, so that we also find out about her culture. And of course, because the nomads are traveling in much higher reaches of the mountains, they have different herbal remedies than Lakshmi is used to using, and they have different plants, different kinds of ingredients that Nimmi is bringing to Lakshmi's life. And then, of course, Lakshmi is intrigued and wants to learn more about them.
So many different worlds in one country and culture. It's amazing. And I thank those nomads because I suspect they're the people who collect the wool. I am known for my scarves, Alka. I love really beautiful decorative scarves and shawls. And I'd say 90% of the ones I have come from India. They're beautiful.
Oh, and aren't they? I have so many scarves myself. And you know, sometimes all you need is a little scarf around your neck and you're warm. You don't need a heavy coat sometimes.
Right. And I can't tell you how many times I'm stopped. I can be in a bookstore, I can be, you know, parking my car, and somebody will stop me and go, oh, I love your scarf or your shawl. So, yeah, they make you feel nice when you've got them on. They're kind of special. One of the things you talk about in the book, at the back, I always like to go to the back of the book, right, and see what authors have put in there. And you've been very generous with some information in there that is interesting, I think, to people who want to learn more about the culture. And one of the things you talk about is Indian gold, a woman's retirement fund. And I remember telling you last time we talked, as a kid, I was always just fascinated by the amount of bangles and gold that the ladies wore. Just going to the market, you know, with my grandmother, and I'd look at all these bangles and beautiful gold bracelets around their ankles, and I'd think, gosh, they're so lovely. Tell us a little bit about that and why you included that in the book.
You know, this is so fortuitous that you and I are talking about this. I just got off of a book group in England, and it was primarily South Asian readers. And we were all talking about this argument that we used to have with our mothers, who always wanted us to wear this 22-carat, 24-carat gold. Because in India, unless you wear 22 to 24-carat gold, which is some of the purest gold that you can have, it's not mixed with an alloy,
right.
Unless you're wearing that, you know, it's somehow as if you are less than. Your status is less. Your place in the world is less. It just means that your family did not have the wherewithal to give you all of that gold. Whatever gold you wear on you is really a badge of pride. It is a mark of pride, and it's a mark of status. So we would all have these arguments with our mothers, like, Mom, I look better in silver. I am much more interested in silver. Please don't make me wear that gold. But in India, it is still such an important part of a woman's wardrobe. And it is her life insurance. So at the time she is married, she is given a quantity of gold that she can either turn into bangles, or maybe it's given to her as bangles and necklaces and earrings and so on by her groom's family. And then she is forevermore allowed to wear this gold, and mostly she is going to wear it because, you know, people don't have safes in their homes, and so you don't want to just leave your gold lying around for anybody to pick up. So mostly they will wear all the gold that they generally have, unless they're uber rich, and then they, you know, probably do have safes in their home and lots of places to put their gold. But most women will wear their gold, and in the event of an emergency, if their husband dies or there's a tragedy or sickness in the family, they can use that gold and parlay it into cash or, you know, to get whatever services they need.
Yeah.
That's the reason for these dowries. And, you know, it's radical for a woman to see her daughter not want to share her gold because she's saying, no, I'm going to pass this gold down to you. You need to wear this.
It's interesting. I never knew that side of things. That's really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about some of the challenging aspects of writing this story. You've already been through the process, and you went, as you said, through about 30 first drafts with your first novel. And so for The Secret Keeper of Jaipur, what were some of the challenging aspects of this particular story? And I'm guessing since the first one did so well, there might have been a little pressure there to match it or do better.
I think everybody with a sophomore novel feels that kind of pressure, like, oh, are my readers going to like this one as much as they like the first one? And of course, you know, I'm hearing from readers all around the world saying, you know, I think I actually like this book better. So, you know, one of the things that was challenging for me in The Secret Keeper of Jaipur is to find Malik's voice, especially because I had only ever spoken in Lakshmi's voice. The henna artist was presented all in her voice. And in this book, I wanted to learn something a little different. I wanted to learn if I could carry three different voices in the same book. And I do think that I've accomplished that, but it took me a while to understand, okay, I know Lakshmi's voice, and I actually know Nimmi's voice. Nimmi is a very formidable character, and she is a great opponent to Lakshmi, and I wanted her to be as strong as Lakshmi was. But with Malik, I know his character, but like, what does he sound like? How does he talk to other people, you know, all throughout his chapters? So, you know, getting into a man's head and a man's perspective and the way a man looks at the opposite sex, the way a man looks at conquest and his work, these are the kind of sort of things that I really have to pay some attention to and rewrite his versions over and over. The other challenging aspect, I think, was trying to figure out how I was going to fit Jaipur into a novel that where we start in Shimla. How are we going to get down to Jaipur? How are we going to get Lakshmi down to Jaipur also, since Shimla is her home now? And, you know, and I find Jaipur really fascinating because that's where most of my extended family lives, and that's where I've been mostly in India. And so, you know, I love Jaipur. I wanted to write about it. And so I thought, how am I going to get all these people down to Jaipur? And I figured out a way to do it. I even thought at one point, I'm going to get Nimmi down to Jaipur. And then I thought, no, I think that's overkill. I don't need to have her come down.
Right. And you also, I mean, this story takes place a decade or so later, right? So the time has changed a little bit during the course of that too. How do you keep track of that in your mind? How do you keep track of... you know, you've got all the characters to keep track of and the places to keep track of. How do you chart that as a writer yourself?
You know, I wish I had an easy answer for you for that, but I don't. I actually don't do these large charts on the wall like a lot of writers do, where they place characters along a timeline and they go, okay, this is what's happening to this character at this time and this time and this time. I just kind of keep it all in my head, or I make little notes mm-hmm. in these little notebooks that I keep. And, for example, I may have one notebook that is all about the nomadic life, and so I will just sort of, glean everything from there that I think I want to include in the book. And then I might have another notebook that is just about Moloch, and so or just about Lakshmi, or just about Nimni. And so I think as I go along, I keep referring back to these notebooks, like, okay, where am I now, and where do I want these characters to be? There is no central design. There's no large chart on my wall where I make all of that happen.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, which probably just tells you how messy my mind is.
Well, no, I it's interesting because I think that's a very organic approach, and I tend to work organically. And I know when we've had some of the same background in the creative world, right, in ad agencies, PR and all that stuff, communications, but they always want to see it laid out on a chart, and it's in my head. I always have to map it out of my head onto a whiteboard so that I can put it into a chart for them. That's interesting.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I do think that we creative types have a different kind of mind. I do think that there are those of us who need the structure of everything being laid out on a whiteboard, or everything being laid out on a large chart. And then there are those of us, like you and me, we don't really need that. We sort of have a compartment in our brain that are organizing different pieces, mm-hmm. and we can draw upon each of those compartments as we are writing the story. So, I think that you know, our minds just work very differently. I think this is one of the reasons why I really disliked having to go to a job, and why I finally founded my own advertising and marketing agency. I didn't like knowing that I have to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning and leave at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Right.
And that, you know, somebody is watching the clock. People are having me fill out timesheets. I just couldn't stand all of that structure. And I think it's just because of, you know, the way that my mind works. My mind does not work as well with structure as it does if I just let myself roam.
Right. Well, that's a great segue into my next question, because I was going to talk about something you have on your website. And just before we jump into that, I think the best creative art director I worked with, we were going to shoot a television commercial. We'd had a very brief, creative brief. It was like da 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 da, and then he looked at me and he said, "Get lost." And I was like, "What?" Because I was new in that role, right? I was like, "What?" And he says, "Get lost and come back when you have an idea." And I was like,
"Oh,
okay. Does that mean I can go ride my bike?" He says, "Do whatever you want." He said, "I don't want to see you until you come back with an outline." So I did. I went and rode my bike, and I thought about it out in the park.
And do you also remember, so this I think you also went through in advertising, you kind of throw away your first 20 ideas.
Oh, yeah.
You just let your mind sort of spew out anything that is coming to you, anything. And I do the same thing with my writing, or with ideas and where I can go next with this character. I let my mind just wander and go, okay, how about this? No, I don't like that. No, how about this? How about this? How about this? So I'm doing the same thing that I used to do in advertising. But it's not until you've gone through all the bad ideas that you come up with a good idea.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so on your website, you talk about my writing process, because I know that's probably the number one question everybody asks authors. And you say there, I don't write full time. I don't see writing as a job that I have to perform. You do your stuff, but you always, always meet your deadlines, because you give yourself that flexibility, and it sounds much more organic approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so much of that is probably training from having worked in the world for 30 years. We always have deadlines, right, our projects. We always have to meet those deadlines. There are lots of people counting on us to meet those deadlines. So there's some kind of an internal clock I have that says, okay, in 5 days this is due. Why don't you get it done in 3 days, and then you have 2 more days to revise and draft and, you know, make it better. So that's kind of how I think in my mind. And I don't write every day because, once again, that would be like a structural thing that would sort of irritate me. So I don't do that. Here is how my mind works. first thing that I see is a scene. So scenes will come to me with color and with characters and with movement and smells and sounds. And it's almost like writing a commercial. So I see a scene. And then I think, okay, who is talking in this scene? What are these people saying? I, you know, work out the dialogue in my head. When I get closer and closer and closer to the final version of that scene, and I'm having these characters move back as if I were the director of this commercial.
Right.
So I'm saying, okay, everybody, go back to your places. Come back and give me something different. Give me more anger. Give me more love. Give me more whatever. And then when I finally think I've worked it out, that's when I finally put it down on my laptop. I don't work ever on a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah, interesting. That's so interesting. And, you know, I've said to many people over the years, because there's this myth out there, you must write every day. I think that's the biggest BS out there. so I'm glad to hear I'm not the only one who doesn't write every day.
I was going to say, I think that would take all the fun out of it. If I wrote every day at a certain time, it would be like a job. And, I can't even exercise at the same hour every day. I do something
right.
different every day. I do it with different people every day and, at a different time. Because if anything becomes rote to me, then it's just boring.
Yes.
And my creative mind cannot put up with it.
Oh my gosh, I'm so with you on that. I was having a conversation with a friend who's an author, and I said, well, I like structure, but I don't like routine. And she goes, well, what's the difference? And I said, I don't know, you know, technically, but for me, it means in my head, I know I have to accomplish A, B, C by X, Y, Z. And how I do it then is up to me. But I hate that, you know, it's 10 o'clock, I have to do this, it's Wednesday, I must do that. So what's your favorite type of scene to write, Alka?
Oh, what an interesting question. I've never had that question before. I think I like scenes where characters are trying to convince the other character. Characters are trying to convince each other of their viewpoint being the correct viewpoint. Because what it forces me to do is to get into other mindsets other than my own and try to see where those characters are coming from. I love those scenes. Mm-hmm. They are very hard to write.
Yeah.
Because I don't always know how another character, you know, is going to react, especially when they're physically or mentally very different from me. But it forces me to actually understand, I think, humanity a little bit more, because I'm forcing myself to understand another point of view.
Yeah.
So I think those are my favorites. But also, I have to tell you, the food scenes are absolutely delicious to write. And I get so hungry while I am writing, because I always incorporate food.
I know, I find myself when I'm reading those, it's like I want to go eat.
Right? I need a samosa right now.
Yeah. And I, for listeners, I mean, you have a nice recipe in the back of the book and a cocktail.
And a cocktail that my older brother put together. You know, when we were kids, or I should say when we were in college, and we would come home for, you know, Christmas vacation or whatever vacation, my mother would ask my older brother, who was the mixologist in the family, he would say, okay, so what cocktail are you going to make this year? And he would always have like a signature cocktail. So he would give my mother all the ingredients. She would have all those ingredients ready and waiting as soon as the three of us arrived from whatever colleges we were coming from.
Wow.
And my older brother would mix the cocktail, and we would just stay up all night just laughing and chatting that first night. It was so much fun. My dad, of course, would go to bed because he had to work the next
right.
day. But, the four of us would just have such a ball. And my mother loved having cocktails and being with us and, you know, having us tell the stories. I think those were moments in her life when she was happiest.
Yes. You know, the last few years of my mom's life, she was quite disabled, but she still had to, she still insisted on cooking our favorite foods for us when we arrived. So I can relate to that. Now, you've had a great deal of marketing experience in your life. I'm sure this has helped you through this process. What are a couple of tips that you'd give somebody who's new to this about the publishing process and being successful about promoting your book? Earlier, you said that you won the online award for the online tour, right? So So what's been your goals with that?
I think that one of the first things that I tell people is that your journey is not over when you turn the book into your publisher. Your journey is going to continue throughout the editing process with your new editor at the publishers. It's going to continue throughout the process with your art department, and you're going to work with them to get the best cover for your book. You're going to work with the marketing department and make sure that what you want to say is exactly what also their vision is, and that you're all aligned to the same vision about your book and the same messages. Then also, your work is not over because you have to figure out what is your story behind the story. That is the most important thing you can do as a writer, is to figure out why you wrote this book, why not somebody else, and also why did you write it at this point in your life? When you can answer those kinds of questions, you are such a long ways from, you're long ways into the path of talking to your readers. Your readers all will want to know, what is your inspiration? Why did you write this book? And I think it's so important to teach these kinds of things in master's programs or in writing programs that they don't currently teach. You need to know what is your story behind the story, and you need to be able to talk about your work. Do not shy away from talking about your work. You put all that hard work into it. You spent years doing different drafts and learning about these characters. Now, this is your chance to talk to everybody about your characters, about your story, about why you wrote what you did. Do not miss that opportunity.
I think that's wonderful advice. And I would add to that, be as enthusiastic and passionate as Alka Joshi is about her book. It's always such a pleasure talking with you. I want listeners to know they can find more about you at alkajoshi.com. The book is The Secret Keeper of Jaipur. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Alka?
I think that there are so many stories in this world. And one of the things I am trying to also accomplish with the Jaipur trilogy is that there are many stories of South Asia, that we are all, no matter what culture we are from, we are more than the stereotypes that people know us as. And it's important for us all to recognize, no matter what culture we are from, that we have many, many different sides to us, that we are complex people, but that we also share a lot with all the other humans on this planet. And I think that the more we can learn about other cultures and learn our similarities, the better off our entire world is going to be.
Yes, I totally agree. Thank you so much for those wise words. Thank you for being with us today. I love your passion, as always. If you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. And we'd love you to join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.